Mike Malloy here. Well, it's just about over. It's just about over. The House voted tonight to, by a vote of 318-97, that we're not going to pay our bills. We're not going to raise the debt ceiling. That's it. With this vote, the every single member of the House, which is every single Republican plus a few Democrats, with this vote, they have declared that the United States is rapidly on its way to becoming a third world country. I don't like the term third world, but for lack of a better term, there we go. That's it. They spoke tonight. For all the talk of economic crisis, should Congress fail to raise the debt ceiling by August? That's when the real deadline is. This was a test run tonight. This vote tonight was intended to make the point to the president that an increase in the debt ceiling is not going to happen unless he starts cutting domestic programs that the Republicans have been trying to get rid of for the past 35 years. But according to R. Bruce Justin, executive vice president of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, quote, "Nah, Wall Street's in on the joke," end quote. A joke. As the Times reports, and for all the talk of economic crisis, should Congress fail to raise the debt ceiling by August, the financial markets are likely to yawn at this vote. Eh, no big deal. Do you know what they're tampering with? What the Republicans, you know, was it last week they voted, the Republicans voted to destroy Medicare? Now, of course, it doesn't mean that much unless the Republicans get control of the Senate, which they don't have right now. And by extension, they've also decided to end Social Security. Now, this is kind of what I was talking about in prior to the last election, the off-year election in 2010. Go ahead and vote the bastards in. Let's have all rational people stay home, don't vote. All the students who voted Barack Obama in, all the younger people who decided to give hope and change one last chance. Everybody stayed home. And the Republicans, of course, the religious crazy, the just bat guano insane right-wingers, all traipsed to the polls and cut their own throats. And they did it deliberately because they were determined to show the Negro in the White House that they are going to be led by a white man, not a black man. This whole thing is based on racism. I mean, turning the people out to vote. The financial markets and the people that wind up in public office, they are hell-bent on ending the middle class. As a matter of fact, I've got three items that I want to share with you during this first hour. Madison Avenue, that's the advertising. You know, Madison Avenue, that's a term that represents the ad industry. They have declared, their top trade journal has declared that the middle class in America has essentially become irrelevant. And they're indicating that if you're over 35 and your income hasn't yet topped $200,000 a year, you're being written off. It's a new white paper, I guess we can use that term, from Ad Age, the advertising industry's top trade journal. And it has declared that mass affluence, which apparently is what has been going on in this country since the late 40s, early 50s, mass affluence. You know, we've always been unlike any other country economically, right? At the end of World War II, Europe was a smoldering rubble. Most of the Far East, smoldering rubble. Central and South America, a bunch of plantations. The real economic monster was the United States. The age, and out of that came what is referred to by Ad Age magazine is mass affluence. We were all affluent. Huh? Well, my family wasn't, but there was always that dream held out in front of your nose. Work hard, be productive, say your prayers at night, and you too can make it. Right? American exceptionalism. By God, we'll do it. According to Ad Age magazine, that is over. The study, New Age of Affluence, details the decline that has occurred since 1960s America, when average families dominated the consumer market. That's the target back in the 60s and even the 70s into the 80s. That mass middle class. That's where the ad dollars were spent, to entice those people to buy things. Well, Madison Avenue has moved on to where the real money is, and that money is not in the pockets of average Americans. Sam Pizzagatti, who is writing at inequality.org, which is a good website. Check it out, inequality.org. And he says, 1960s America, where average families dominated the consumer market, has totally disappeared, according to this Ad Age study. And Madison Avenue, the advertising industry, has begun to and is going to continue to move on to where the money really is, and that money is not in the pocket of average Americans. The global economic recession, Ad Age says, has thrown, quote, a spotlight on the yawning divide between the richest Americans and everyone else. Taking inflation into account, Ad Age goes on to explain this, quote, the income of most American workers has remained more or less static since the 1970s, while the income of the rich and the very rich has grown exponentially. Yep. The top 10% of American households, the trade journal adds, now accounts for nearly half of all consumer spending. You get that? The top 10%. That's not you. Well, it might be a couple of you. Damn sure isn't me. But the top 10% of American households now account for nearly half of all consumer spending. And a disproportionate share of that spending comes from the top 10's upper reaches. You got to get up to that top 1 or 2%. Now, I've mentioned before how I get the New York Times every morning, and I look on the front page, and there will be pictures of horrible war, death, disaster, poverty. I think on page 2 or 3, or page 3 today, or page 4, or was it yesterday, picture of workers in the African country of Guinea that are being exploited by American oil companies and the dictator that has run that country for 30 years. And around the edges of the pages, well, they talk about workers in Guinea. Is it Guinea? I think it is. Well, they talk about workers there averaging, $3 a month. There are ads in the New York Times for diamond bracelets, silver this, gold that, a watch for $26,000, a bracelet for $110,000, shoes for $1,500. And I look at that and I think, okay, it's New York City. But, I mean, it just is staggering. More on this. Don't go away. You're gonna like tonight's show, because probably, well, stick around. Not for me, not for you. It's a wonderful life. No stress, no strife. Never worry, never worry. And young, well, I wonder what great things they've done to become the fortunate one. They're the happy members of the Lucky Sperm Club. The only thing they have to do is be conceived. It's great to be a member of the Lucky Sperm Club. Living in the life of lazy luxury.
to the Flying Monkey Right. It's Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. By the way, this hour is sponsored by Greg Arnold. He's honoring the San Francisco branch of the Freedom Socialist Party with a quote from Leon Trotsky from 1868. Marxism is saturated with the optimism of progress. And that alone, by the way, makes it irreconcilably opposed to religion. End quote. Leon Trotsky. Thank you, Greg. We're talking about the middle class is no longer holds any interest whatsoever for the advertising whiz-bangs who determine where ad dollars will be spent. If you considered yourself middle class, your days are numbered, which means the days of this republic are numbered, because once the middle class goes, and it's going rapidly, then the violence will begin. You think I'm kidding? You know it as well as I do. Simply put, sums up Ad Age's David Hirschman, a small plutocracy of wealthy elites drives a larger and larger share of total consumer spending and has outsized purchasing influence, particularly in categories such as technology, financial services, travel, automotive, apparel, and personal care, end quote. America as a whole, this new Ad Age study pauses to note, hasn't quite caught up with the reality of this steep inequality. Most people are asleep. Most people are talking about Sarah Palin and her freak show, or they're wondering what's Donald Trump and Sarah, what are they going to have for supper when they get together later this week? And then this goddamn CNN puts this filthy pig Andrew Breitbart on the air today to talk about his latest scam to make it look like Anthony Weiner, the representative from New York, is chasing young women. CNN does that. The whole goddamn country is collapsing. You're aware of that, right? You are aware of that. I'm surprised that there is not already rioting in the streets. Well, it'll start soon. We're entering into this, the hideous beast of a double dip recession where it concerns housing prices. Have you been following this? And the Republicans continue to throw matches on this fire that's already burning. These rancid bastards continue to bring cans of gasoline. When? Well, I'm getting sick of asking the question. When will the American people wake up and take to the streets and end this insanity? I don't know what it's going to take, but apparently we have more pain to suffer before we decide it's time to stop this. The Ad Age study says, like I just mentioned, that America hasn't quite caught up with the reality of this inequality. It goes on to say Americans, quote, still like to believe in an egalitarian ideal of affluence where everyone has an equal shot at amassing a great fortune through dint of hard work and ingenuity. So many Americans still believe that. What the hell is it going to take before people come out of the ether and realize that it is time to rip capitalism into a million pieces, stomp it into the dirt, burn it, cast it to the winds, end it, stop it? What's it going to take? Wish I had an answer. The Ad Age white paper makes no moral judgments about any of this, of course. The ad industry's only interest is follow the money, because the money determines who consumes or buys stuff. The Ad Age story goes, report goes on, quote, as the very rich become even richer, they amass greater purchasing power, creating an increasingly concentrated market for luxury goods and services, as well as consumer goods overall, end quote. So, if in the future, if current trends continue, no one else but the rich will essentially matter to advertisers and the people that are selling the junk. That may be a good idea, but we've got to purge this society of the disease. I mean, Jesus, God, if you get strep throat, you go get an antibiotic. This country is being eaten alive. The Ad Age white paper bluntly sums it up like this, quote, "More than ever before, the wealthiest households would be the households with significant disposable income to spend." So, the people who are going to make it, this new universe, will be populated by men and women under the age of 35, who make between $100,000 and $200,000. That will be the only group that will be expected to graduate on into the affluent society that Ad Age sees as coming. There's going to be a top 2 or 3% and a bottom 97%, unless the system is ended.
Yourself with the truth. It's more Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. I get really concerned sometimes when I think that all this is going on, this ending of the United States as an economic leader. This ending of the middle class. When I was a kid, we were in the lower reaches of the working class. And you know, my big aspiration, I never had an aspiration to be wealthy. I just wanted to be in that middle class as I saw it as a kid growing up in Toledo. Of course, that doesn't exist anymore. And I wonder sometimes, kids who are 10, 11, 12 years old, what do they aspire to economically? Maybe, with any luck, they will not aspire to any kind of participation in this bloody capitalist system at all. But, you know, my generation and the one right before me and the one right behind me, we were, and generations going all the way back to the founding of this country, we were taught exploitation, you know, step on your neighbor, fight to get to the top of the heap. You got to get into the middle class, and once you're there, unless you're born there, then you got to keep going up, 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 climb the ladder. All the metaphors were in place. You got to keep doing it, keep burning, consuming, eating, stuffing, ending, chopping, dig more, consume more, bigger car, bigger house, bigger this, more expensive shoes, shoes $2, nah, shoes $200, shoes $2,000, keep going, keep going, keep going, up, up, up. What? What? Even the people who created that universe, the mythical Madison Avenue, you know, the advertising agencies, even the people who created that are saying it's over. So where are Americans on this issue? Where's the big decision? That's one of the reasons, I think, of the rise, if there is a rise, there seems to be a rise, in this crazed fundamentalist Christianity, this obscenity that is fundamentalist Christianity. I mean, the same can be said about Judaism fundamentally and Islam. They're all crazed, but the Muslims and the Jews in this country are not the ones condemning everyone to hell and trying to destroy the schools and I don't know. I just don't quite. I'm not equipped to grasp it. And what I'm finding I'm doing more and more, and maybe a lot of other people are doing this, although, you know, if you don't work in this business where you're constantly exposed to this, constantly picking at this scab, like I have to do, like people in this business have to do, media business or what, well, not all media business, but I don't know where I'm going with the sentence. I'm starting to just get to the point where I'm toying with the idea of just not caring anymore. Just screw it. You know, really questioning. And I wonder about other liberals who work in any kind of media work, anything, blogs, internet stuff, internet radio, over-the-air radio, satellite radio, television, the few that are ensconced, the two or three over at MSNBC. There's only two, really. What are they thinking about? The writers at The Nation who've been through crap since the 1800s, they've seen ups and downs, but I don't hear any discussion among us common folk about the collapse that's occurring. And I think if the collapse does not result in a totalitarian dictatorship in this country, which it very easily could. You know, fascism in the United States has always been just about one inch below the topsoil. It's always been there, just waiting for the right moment. And after corporatism, after capitalism, the next natural step is to fascism. I mean, come on. don't make an uneducated slob like me have to try to explain that to you. But the combination of this corporatism / incipient fascism and fundamentalist religion, you know, it's an historical truth. As things get rougher or scarier, people turn more and more to sky spooks and things that are flying around in the air and invisible playmates and voices in their head and, you know, the screaming demand that whatever the religion promised them about rapture or being saved from this horror, that it comes to fulfillment. And the preachers that become the most successful are these crazy bastards and bastardettes who get out there and just scream about, you know, the gays this and the communists this and the socialists and the liberals, and we got to get God back in the school and we got to get rid of that Social Security. It's a demon trip, and we got to get rid of Medicare, and we need a balanced budget. We need a Jesus would have insisted on a balanced budget. So I don't know about you, Truth Seeker. You know, I've talked before on this 10-cent radio program about, you know, denial and avoidance and how they are great evolutionary tools. Always have been. You know, even Richard Bach in, I don't know, what was it? In what was the book, Kathy? Not Seagull, but the other one, Illusions. When he said there's no problem so big it can't be walked away from. I'm paraphrasing. I'm not sure that's the exact quote. But, you know, if you don't like the movie, get your ass out of your seat and walk out. That simple. So denial and avoidance, great coping mechanisms, the essential coping mechanisms, the coping mechanisms upon which every other coping mechanism is built. It starts with avoidance and denial. And in you know, the middle years of my life, I've tried to stay away from that. You know, I don't mean to make this sound goofy, but I did enough acid, enough psychotropic drugs to realize that avoidance and denial are just that. Avoidance and denial. You know, they're the worst kind of illusions. But I'm starting to think maybe it's an evolutionary tool for obvious reasons. I mean, when it was first put together, what? People had to avoid and deny the existence of beasts waiting outside the cave to eat them. Well, here we are. We've got beasts outside the cave now. Of course, we are, some of us, smarter. We don't have to do avoidance and denial. I keep telling myself that, just in my little world. Come on, Mike, don't go there. Don't go there. Come on, come on, come on. Remember what Don Juan said. Remember what Don Gennaro said. Don't go into that place. Come on, come on. It's a struggle. Whew. Did I mention that this hour is sponsored by Greg Arnold, whose message is honoring, he's sponsoring it in honor of the San Francisco branch of the Freedom Socialist Party, with a quote from Leon Trotsky: Marxism is saturated with the optimism of progress. And that alone, by the way, makes it irreconcilably opposed to religion. Last Wednesday, shortly after 5 p.m., as Isaiah Poole mentions at, or talks about at ourfuture.org, there was a roll call vote in the House that some Republicans were kind of dreading. The roll call vote began, and the public began to know the names of, no, this was in the Senate, the names of the senators who were willing to throw the middle class under the bus for the corporate class that is represented in the 2012 House Republican budget resolution, that one Paul Ryan's budget. So there was a roll call vote in the Senate. It was a critical vote. The conservatives dominating the budget debate in Washington should not be allowed to escape accountability for the policies they advocate. Where a member of Congress stands on this 2012 Republican budget is without a doubt this year's most important marker of whether that member stands with working or men and women or the middle class, retirees, and those struggling to climb the economic ladder, or against them. More on this when we come back. Stay with us. For the hour, this hour is sponsored by Greg Arnold, honoring the San Francisco branch of the Freedom Socialist Party, with a quote from Leon Trotsky from way back, 1868. Quote, Marxism is saturated with the optimism of progress. And that alone, by the way, makes it irreconcilably opposed to religion. End quote. By the time the vote on the resolution ended in the U.S. Senate, it was 40 senators, all Republicans, who voted for the resolution, which proposes turning Medicare into a private insurance voucher program and does violence to other programs vital to the interests of middle and low-income households. 57 senators voted against the resolution, including 5 Republicans. What a difference an aroused electorate makes, right? If this is an indication of an aroused electorate, it is to Isaiah Poole, who wrote this at ourfuture.org last month. The conservative establishment and Washington punditocracy praised House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan for his courage in leading House Republicans to vote for that budget plan. But that was before the special election in New York. That somehow the monsters that walk among us didn't quite get to the voting machines in time and reprogram them. I guess they figured the Republican was safe. I mean, after all, the last election, the Republican won with a 76% vote total. So I guess tampering with those machines, if machines were used, was just kind of not given the attention that it needed to guarantee the election of a Republican. As a result, a Democrat was elected. And she was elected on the basis that she was not going to allow anybody to tamper with Medicare, Social Security, Medicaid. This is Rust Belt cities. See, the Republicans are so full of themselves that they are convinced, and this may be true, that no matter how desperate Americans get, no matter how far they see sinking into oblivion the equity they thought they had in their houses, no matter how long it takes for middle-class Americans to realize they are not going to get that job back, no matter how long it takes, the Republicans know one thing for sure. They can continue, or they think they can, continue to get Americans to vote, continue to vote against their own best economic interests over and over and over again by just using certain triggers, most of which are absolute lies. But this is what happens when you have a totally uninformed, uneducated, stupid ass electorate. People say, well, I'm against abortion and I vote. Well, good for you, booby. Good for you. And while you're against abortion and you're voting, you realize, of course, that you're reaching deep into your own insides and just with a knife slashing yourself into ribbons. Do you understand that? So the next time you go to the bathroom and your toilet fills up with blood and you sit there and you look at it and go, well, how'd that happen? You did it to yourself. And you're going to keep doing it. You're going to keep doing it. At least that's what the Republicans are counting on. That's what the corporatocracy counts on. That's what capitalism has always counted on. We had a brief period here in this country from the 30s until the late 70s, a brief 40-year period. 50-year period, where a third of the workforce was unionized. The government stepped in repeatedly to pull back or defend against the worst excesses of capitalism. It never happened like this before. And it so pissed off the ruling class that they seriously considered assassinating Franklin Roosevelt. They did assassinate John F. Kennedy. They did assassinate Robert Kennedy. They did assassinate Martin Luther King Jr. Because the ruling class started to panic. Oh, my God, a middle class? But that's where revolution is born. Always in the middle class. That's a relative term in various countries. But always. The rich don't lead a revolution. What are you kidding? And the poor are too goddamn hungry. Who does that leave? But they just keep doing it and doing it and doing it. The Republicans. because they know that what they're dealing with. The little thing that occurred in the 26th District in New York last week, where is it Kathy Hochul who got elected over the Republican in a district that has been Republican for 70 years? That's a blip. That's a blip. And it really doesn't matter anyway. You know, the chattering classes put so much focus and attention. Oh, my God, the revolution has begun. No, it hasn't. You know when the revolution will begin? When people finally take to the streets by the millions and say, no, God damn it, you're not going to kill me. You're not going to kill my children and my dreams. I'm sick of it. I'm tired of it. I'm pulling this son of a bitch down, and I'm burning it. That's when the revolution will start.
When did your life start?
During the break, sent me this quote from John Steinbeck. I don't know if I've ever seen this before. Probably not. Here's the quote. Socialism never took root in America because the poor see themselves not as an exploited proletariat, but as temporarily embarrassed millionaires. Is that really a Steinbeck quote, Manfred? Socialism never took root in America because the poor see themselves not as an exploited proletariat, but as temporarily embarrassed millionaires. That's a good one. I don't care who made it. You know, if Steinbeck said that, okay, that's great. Now, all this talk about gutting Medicare, turning it into a voucher system. By the way, Andy Borowitz has a plan. This is what Borowitz is reporting. It's not his plan. The Republicans propose replacing Social Security with Groupons. Presenting what he called a revolutionary plan to slash the nation's mountain of debt, Representative Paul Ryan today proposed eliminating the Social Security program in its entirety and replacing it with Groupons. Ryan said in an appearance on Fox News, quote, instead of waiting each month for a check from Social Security, America's elderly will receive valuable Groupons for everything they need, from ramen noodles to cat food to caskets. End quote. Adding that Groupons would also help provide for elders' medical needs, the congressman illustrated his point by holding up a Groupon offering 30% off on open-heart surgery in Cincinnati. Moving on from Social Security, Mr. Ryan also proposed replacing Medicare with a new program in which seniors are shot at by predator drones. Additionally, Mr. Ryan said in his budget, in his new budget, so-called friends with benefits would lose their benefits. He said, quote, if they're really friends, they should be satisfied if the evening ends with a voucher. Speaker of the House John Boehner, appearing alongside Representative Ryan, offered these words of praise for the Wisconsin congressman. Quote, preachers like Harold Camping go around predicting the end of the world, but it's guys like Paul Ryan who do the hard work of making it happen. End quote. What time is it? Andy Borowitz. The Borowitz Report. It's not just about Medicare. And as Isaiah Poole writes, although Medicare is an appropriate symbol of the larger issue, what Ryan proposed for Medicare, and Republicans in the House almost unanimously voted in favor of, is the remaking of a government program based on core conservative principles that put private markets and individualism over the common good and shared responsibility. Conservatives have often profited when they've been able to sell these principles in the abstract, but they are now seeing what happens when citizens get a sense of their merciless Darwinian impact in the real world. Ooh, Isaiah, that sounds so dialectical. But you got to remember something, my friend. The Democrat who won the 26th district won with a plurality, not a majority of the vote. In fact, if you combine the Republican and the insane teabagger, they beat her by 10 points. Kind of like the way Clinton got elected, right? So, you know, all this talk about the 26th district in New York, ooh, it's the dawning of the age of something. No, it isn't. It's not going to happen that way. Things are not going to be turned around at the ballot box. Oh, my God. Isaiah goes on, the truth is that on just about every critical area of concern to working class households, the 2012 budget resolution lays the foundation for devastation. That's what it's going to take. It's going to take, and this is what infuriates me, because it didn't have to be this way. It didn't have to be this way. Except for the fact that people in this country are dumber than dog crap. It didn't have to be that way. Now, it's to the point where the ballot box is not going to turn anything around. Do you really think it is? How much longer can you think that? When is that? When? When's it going to happen? Kathy Hochul won with a minority of the vote, a plurality of the vote, not a majority. It's not some sign in heaven that the Democrats or the progressives or common sense or the middle class or is going to survive. It's not that. Revolutions do not begin at a ballot box. Jesus God. That's sometimes where they end, but it's not where they begin. Isaiah goes on, by replacing Medicare's system of guaranteed comprehensive health coverage with a so-called defined contribution to a private insurance plan that each senior would choose, seniors would find themselves paying more out-of-pocket costs or choosing to self-ration medical care. Well, I think I'll pass on the bypass operation. What the hell? I'm 74. Bible says 70. I'm on Jesus time already by 4 years. Tail with it. In converting Medicaid, Isaiah goes on, to a block grant, low-income people would find themselves at the mercy of 50 different standards for the amount of health care the citizens of their state would be willing to offer. Now, who's on Medicaid? Don't kid yourself, Bubala, into thinking that the only people who are on Medicaid are those people who don't have bootstraps or refuse to pull themselves up. Are you serious? You are going to be on it soon. Are you not aware of that? How old are you? 38? How much do you make a year? Oh, you're not working. So, Medicaid was a good idea when there was still a few shreds, not much, but a few shreds of sanity left in our political slash economic system. That was for people who were too young to qualify for Medicare and just couldn't quite get over the hump where it concerned making enough money to buy private insurance, and private insurance was skyrocketing way faster than the cost of living or inflation. It was going out of control because the predators, the filthy, 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 filthy health insurance predators figured it out. And Americans still haven't. They don't give a damn if you're sick or healthy. They don't care about you, some operation or doctor's visit. If you follow their stinking little rules and pay your premiums, they'll go along with it until finally they say, okay, that's enough for her. God damn. Let me see her original application. Oh, look here. When she was 13, she had a mole removed. Well, aha. Uh-huh. Oh, that's not on her application. No, that's on the HIPAA stuff or whatever it's called that floats through the ozone. The Ethernet. She had a mole and she didn't tell us about it. Cut her off. But she desperately needs surgery now. We don't care. We're not in the business to get people well or pay their bills. You out of your mind? We're in the business to make a profit. Cut her off now. How soon before that her is you?
Truth seekers, it's time for your humble and obedient servant, Mike Malloy.
Hour. Slight correction. The Steinbeck quote is, socialism never took root in America because the poor see themselves not as an exploited proletariat, but as temporarily impoverished millionaires. Thanks for the correction. For working class and middle class families expecting to send their kids to college, which is becoming more and more of just one more financial patch of quicksand, the Paul Ryan plan cuts Pell Grants and would put an affordable college education out of reach of significant numbers of college students. Not only do the capitalist bastards, the corporatists, not only do they want everything for the top 2 or 3%, but they want to make sure that the masses are not educated. The destruction of the middle class is essential for this scam to be pulled off. And meanwhile, what is the middle class doing in this country? Worrying a lot, panicked a lot, angry at gay people, black people, Muslims. What is the middle class in this country doing? Sucking on the tailpipe. got their mouth wrapped around the tailpipe of that 400 horsepower engine, just sucking down that carbon monoxide, just working, the middle class is working its way to its own death. Just helping these bastards, just helping them. And the Republicans, the conservatives, the capitalists, the corporatists, whatever you want to call them, the religious crazy people, they're just like, yes, we knew it. They're dumber than dirt. They'll never rebel. They allowed war criminals to run their country. War criminals, by the definitions set up by them. War criminals. And they did nothing. And when their speaker said, well, impeachment's off the table. And the Republicans looked at it and said, God damn, this is incredible. This is so good. We managed to impeach a president for lying about oral sex. And these dumbasses won't impeach war criminals. That's all it took. That's all it took. Yeah. Oh, and prior to that, December 12th, 2000, when the U.S. Supreme Court, five members, ended representative government in this country for once and for all, ended it, told the state of Florida that they did not have the right to count all the votes of the people who voted in the presidential election. The U.S. Supreme Court essentially told the Supreme Court of Florida, you cannot so order that all the votes will be counted. And what happened? What happened when that's happened in other countries? People go into the streets and they shoot, and they are shot at, and some of them die, and there's blood all over the goddamn place. And usually the repressive government wins, but the people make a stand. And they say no, goddammit. What happened here? Nothing. Nothing. Even the press in this country said, move on. There's no there. Keep going. Move on. Go. And then, of course, September 11th, 2001. So, given what has happened in this country politically, just the past decade, 11 years, does anybody really believe that the outcome of an election in a small House district in upstate New York means anything? Are you crazy? But that's what we're being told. Oh, the revolution has begun. Oh, no, it hasn't.
Thank you.
here, right now, Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. Almost done with Isaiah Poole's piece at ourfuture.org. He's talking about the Ryan Republican budget and how it is designed. It is designed to destroy what's left of the middle class. See, once you eliminate the middle class completely, yeah, you may have angry people wandering the streets trying to find food to eat or talking trash talk about, well, I'm not going to take this anymore. But when you run a national security state the way the United States has, as we have turned into, it doesn't take long to put battle-hardened people on the streets with orders not unlike the ones given to the Chinese military by the Chinese leadership. Shoot the sons of bitches. Stability is all that matters. Shoot them. The Economic Policy Institute says that the Ryan budget could actually cost the economy well over a million jobs over the next 5 years. Another million jobs down the toilet. Also, the Republican budget would have no impact on the federal deficit. Nothing. The $4.3 trillion in spending cuts, offset by $4.2 trillion in tax cuts for millionaires, billionaires, and capitalist corporations. Why is this so hard to understand for the vast majority of Americans? Why is it so hard to, A, understand, B, do something about it? I mean, why are we all just willing to walk to the slaughter? I don't understand that. No, I'm not going to use a Holocaust analogy now. We have our own way in this country of being sound asleep when it's desperately necessary for us to be wide awake and reacting to this as if we're on methamphetamines. And we shouldn't be reacting anyway. We should be acting. What's the word that everybody talked about? Proactive. We got to get proactive. What the hell does that mean? They had to invent a new word? What's wrong with active? No. Has to be proactive. What does that mean? What is proactive? There were a series of other votes last Wednesday on competing budget resolutions designed to get senators on the record on where they stood. They all failed to get the necessary simple majority to prevail. So, what should the Senate do now? For one thing, Isaiah Poole says, listen to the American public? What? He goes on, while the media and the right-wing spin machine has whipped up the crisis atmosphere around the federal deficit, people living their daily lives on Main Street know the real crisis is a jobs crisis. And while they are deeply skeptical of what government can do to put people back to work, you see right there. Either Isaiah Poole at ourfuture.org is revealing his willingness to bend over yet again for the bosses, or he totally misreads what is really being said by the people on Main Street. Or, third possibility, the people on Main Street are so goddamn brain dead and out of touch with their own destiny that they really are skeptical of what government can do to put people back to work. Are you serious? Government put millions of people back to work in the 30s. Millions! And out of that came what? Oh, I know. Came World War II. That was in there too, right? Well, that had to do with the rise of fascism. Millions of people went back to work. Barack Obama could do it tomorrow, last week, a year ago, 2 years ago, with a stroke of the pen. And then toss it to the House for funding. Explain it to the people, Mr. President, what you're going to do. You're going to put 10 million people to work with the stroke of a pen. Wipe out unemployment. How do you do that? Infrastructure. The whole goddamn country is falling apart, not just emotionally, psychologically, economically. It's also falling apart from a structural, on a structural level. All you have to do, Mr. President, is just put together the plan. Get the goddamn banksters out of your White House. Get the filthy pigs out. They're killing you, us, them, all of us. Get them out. Listen to Robert Reich. Listen to Robert Reich. Listen to Joseph Stiglitz. Listen to Paul Krugman. We could have 5 million, 6 million, 7 million people to work with the stroke of the president's pen. And yet, Isaiah Poole, writing at ourfuture.org, bless his heart, says, and while the people are deeply skeptical of what government can do to put people back to work, they do demand government leadership. What the hell does that sentence mean? I mean, no offense to Isaiah Poole. He's just trying to get the word out. He goes on to say, the public will back a progressive plan that puts people back to work, doing work in our communities that must be done to set the stage for future prosperity, even as officials work to restore the public's trust that their tax dollars are being used wisely. Nobody gives a goddamn fig about whether or not their tax dollars are being used wisely. They haven't been used wisely for as long as there has been a massive U.S. military machine. I want my tax dollars used wisely. Oh, yeah? What does that mean? I don't want people getting food stamps. Is that what that means? Yep. I don't want trillions going to foreign aid. But trillions don't go to foreign aid. As a matter of fact, foreign aid is 2-3% of what we spend. No, it's not. No, it's not. I know it's not. Isaiah concludes by saying what the public does not want is Washington conservative elites telling them that seniors at some point may have to go without health care so that ExxonMobil can continue to rake in record profits without paying taxes on those profits. Well, Isaiah, that's true. But that's what they sit around and bitch and whine about, the American public you're referring to. That's what makes them fertile ground for fascism. And they don't even realize it, for totalitarianism. They don't realize that the very form of government that they think they're railing against is the form of government that's making them think that to begin with. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. He goes on, they don't want to hear that the Pell Grants their college-age children receive, or the job training that their unemployed father gets on the community development grants that their city town would use to fix up neighborhoods, blah, 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 are being cut so a hedge fund manager can keep his tax rate lower than the people who serve him his latte at the corner coffee shop. That's great rhetoric. I love that. I love that. Amen. Hey, goddamn amen. Yes, yes. But Isaiah doesn't inspire anybody. Gets me all head up. I'm just back to cussing like a sailor on the radio program here. He goes on, the American public, they don't want to hear that an economic policy that has consistently failed to work for working people is somehow going to be a good deal now. But Isaiah, the only thing wrong, it's not wrong, I mean, I'm not going to criticize your creativity, pal. You write, I blab. I'm not going to criticize your creativity, but the only thing wrong with what you're saying is that may be what people talk about with their spouse or sit around with a guy they used to work alongside and say, God damn, man, I'm getting tired of this. Yeah, me too. What do you want to do about it? Well, maybe I'll vote Democratic next time. I've been voting Republican for 40 years now. Maybe I'll vote Democratic. What do you think? Well, I don't know. That might work. Robert Reich, writing at his blog site, has something up that I was thinking about sharing it with you, but I don't know. It's called The Truth About the American Economy. I don't know. Maybe I will next hour. I'm giving myself a headache tonight. I'm ready to stroke out here. And it's not worth it. It's just, by God, not worth it. So, avoidance and denial, great evolutionary tools that you know, along with this insatiable prime directive to get your genes into the next generation, you put all three of those together, and they've worked real well, and here we are, all 7 billion of us, and so on and so forth. But I'll tell you, avoidance and denial is not going to work too much longer where it concerns what's really going on. You know what I'm saying?
Without dissent, it's not America. Here's Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. Bruce Enberg, a.k.a. Prairie 2. Hey, brother, can you spare a dime? It's official. This depression is worse than the last one. Home prices are seriously sliding down again, having dipped 33% since the peak of 2006. And they're still falling. In the 1930s, home prices only fell 31% at the worst point of the Depression. The only reason the depth of our plight isn't more apparent is that in 1932, there was no meaningful safety net. In 1932, the largest single cause of death for Americans was starvation in summer and freezing to death in the winter. It was mostly, but not exclusively, the elderly that succumbed this way. The very young died, too, but usually from diseases made epidemic by malnutrition. Today, 1 in 6 Americans receive food stamps, and it's 1 in 4 for children. You would be seeing people starving in the streets on an even greater scale than 1932, if not for Uncle Sugar, as the right-wingers put it. Fully half of Americans receive some sort of aid from the government, if you include earned income tax credits. The right wing says this is unsustainable. We must eliminate these handouts so that people will pull themselves up by their bootstraps. No food stamps. No women's, infants, and children feeding programs for babies. No unemployment for the lazy bums. No Medicaid for all the freeloaders. 65% of nursing home care is paid by Medicaid. Eliminate teachers' pensions and cut government workers' pay. That'll fix everything, they say. The truth is, right-wingers, cover up your ears. The truth is that Republicans have turned government assistance programs into a corporate subsidy to guarantee a cheap supply of labor. The minimum wage is barely half what it should be to match 1938 standards, but food stamps and free medical care for kids keep people working for those wages. The low wages at the bottom also help drag down wages across the board, especially when coupled with 20% unemployment, which is comparable with depression levels. If Republicans are successful with still more cutbacks, these numbers will only get worse, as a large portion of the economy only exists on government aid, and all of the jobs the spending creates would disappear, adding to the mass of starving people. The easy conclusion to jump to is that at some point, the people will rebel against this. Certainly they will. But they've already tried democracy. What makes you think they'll make that mistake again? The reason some European countries all fell into fascism in the 20s and 30s was that the people had no collective memory of democracy and fell for the first guy who told them what they wanted to hear. Our collective memory of democracy has been all but erased. Ronald Reagan was able to sell his appeal for the good old days on the notion that government isn't the solution, it's the problem. Democracy requires government. But the teabaggers think real democracy is the marketplace. Or in other words, they believe in the benevolent corporation. Major public buildings and even schools display the corporate logos of their kind benefactors. Nobody questions why these corporations don't pay any taxes, but yet the little guy pays ever more taxes and receives ever less in wages from these benevolent corporate overlords. The oil industry says 40% of what you pay for gas goes to Wall Street. That's a pretty stiff tax. That's why they have trillions. And John Boehner says, we're broke. We're not broke. We're just ignorant by design. Pray too. Well, well, well. I think I will do the Robert Reich thing when we come back. Oh, and there's something else that just was sent to me about Ginny Thomas. Supreme Court Justice Uncle Clarence Thomas, he released his new financial disclosure form on Friday under pressure from Representative Anthony Weiner. You know what happened to Anthony Weiner shortly after. I'll share all this with you when you come back. What does it matter about Uncle Clarence and his old lady? How does that matter at all? Well, it matters because it demonstrates the ruling class attitude toward you. And you poor, miserable teabagger, you poor, miserable Republican, conservative listening to this program tonight. Unless you're one of the wealthy few, and if you're one of the wealthy few, you're not listening because you can't stand what comes over this program. But if you're a Republican and you're, you know, cruising around the country listening on Sirius XM, you're listening to one of the radio stations you carry, or maybe an internet stream, do you not understand what they're doing to you? And if you don't, why don't you? I will be back. 7 past the hour. This is the Molloy program. You still there? Oh, my God. You're still here. This hour is sponsored by Russell Noel. Thanks, Russell. Thank you very much. Are you aware of what Representative Anthony Weiner, Democrat in New York, what his little embarrassing moment today brought to you by the scum-sucking Andrew Breitbart? Are you aware? Apparently, Weiner's Twitter account was hacked, and placed on it was a picture, a crotch shot of a guy. I don't know how much was revealed, but this filthy, degenerate psychopath, Breitbart, who's behind all this, of course, you know, is all over television, and this is what drives me insane. Media gives this pig any kind of attention at all. All over television, using the kind of derogatory shorthand and ugliness, Rep. Weiner. Well, I don't know, Rep. Weiner, you know, referring to a member of Congress that way. I don't agree with Anthony Weiner on a lot of stuff, but, you know, he is what he is. He's a member of the U.S. House. But there is this filthy, degenerate Breitbart talking about Rep. Weiner. Well, I don't know, pursuing young girls, is that what he's doing? This is what the Republicans always go for. The Republican men always go for the, trying to force sex onto their underlings. And the Republican operatives always trying to insinuate some kind of sexual misconduct by Democrats. It's just astonishing to watch, right? So we have to take a little detour and put up with this garbage. The reason they went after Weiner, though, it's very simple. Weiner tweeted, or twittered, what do you call it? Tweeted, yeah. He was taunting Supreme Court Justice Uncle Clarence Thomas. Because Mother Jones reported that Uncle Clarence's newly released financial disclosure forms, just released on Friday, show that his wife, Ginny, received $150,000 salary from the group Liberty Central this past year, and $15,000 from an anti-healthcare reform lobbying firm she founded. I mean, that's really goddamn cool, man. Set up a company, pay yourself. Hell, we did that with Molloy Broadcasting. That's pretty cool. Yeah, we know how that works, right? Anti-healthcare reform lobbying firm. Liberty Central, which she also helped found, supports the repeal of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. You know, the health insurance reform thing that was a gift to the health insurance corporate fascist pigs. But because it has Obama's signature on it, we got to get this guy out of the White House. See, Anthony Weiner had taunted Thomas via Twitter on Friday. But then all of a sudden, here along comes Wienergate, the fiasco that broke out Sunday. Weiner had previously called on Uncle Clarence to recuse himself from cases involving health care reform because of his wife's financial connections to groups dedicated to its repeal. I mean, for Christ's sake! The Republicans, black or white, they don't care about it. Well, Weiner, shut up, sit down, be careful, or we'll unleash this foaming, frothing little prick Breitbart to put a phony photo on your Twitter site. A letter written by Weiner and signed by 74 members of Congress said, quote, "The appearance of a conflict of interest merits recusal under federal law. From what we have already seen, the line between your impartiality and you and your wife's financial stake in the overturn of health care reform is blurred." Blurred? You see, the Ethics in Government Act of 1978 requires Supreme Court justices to disclose their spouse's income, but Thomas had not disclosed his wife's financial disclosure forms for 20 years. And why should he? He's protected. George Herbert Walker Bush, when he was nominated, called Clarence Thomas the most qualified individual to sit on the Supreme Court in America. Well, that automatically qualifies him to not have to file disclosure forms as required by law, in addition to the fact that he was the most qualified nominee for the Supreme Court in, I don't know, the history of the Republic? Whatever. Wiener said Friday in a statement, quote, "We knew that Justice Thomas's family," you mean his wife, "had a financial stake in opposing health care reform. Now we know even more. It's pretty clear that Justice has one option here, recusal." Well, you know, Clarence gets on the horn and calls up, Grover Norquist, and Norquist calls up Matt Sludge, and Sludge calls up whoever he calls up, and they decide to go for the scum sucker who will do the dirty work. They get Breitbart. He does the wet work for this these proto-fascists. So they say to Breitbart, okay, you got to do something about Wiener. No problem, man. No problem. Watch his Twitter account about 15 minutes from now. So that's what Wienergate. Wienergate. Jesus, God. You know, if somebody would ever lead a movement to stop the imposition of the suffix gate onto every little manufactured or real scandal, just ever since Watergate, gate, Iran gate, Afghanistan gate, Iraq gate, Bush gate, Cheney gate, torture gate. Sons of bitches. Oh, man. So, the other thing that the media are doing is following this Sarah Palin bus. I mean, this is where one really wants to get a hold of the assignment editors for the networks, whether they're cable or over the air. I'm not talking about Fox. Fox is a nest of pigs and louses. But get a hold of the assignment editors and say, what are you doing? This woman is no more, she's got an ice cube's chance in hell of being elected to anything. The last thing she was elected to, she quit. So she could go become a movie star.
Yeah.
I'm a movie star. I travel around and look, Donald Trump is having dinner with me. I am so famous. Woo. And this filthy, disgusting corporate media, especially television. And sad to say, New York Times. Ah, New York Times, I hardly knew ye. But especially television, they're following around like dogs in heat. It's just like a pack of sex-starved hound dogs following the one that's leaving the spore, and they just have to go. They just have to go. They got to trap. They have aerial shots of her bus, for Christ's sake. Why? You smell it? Oh, my God. Yeah, that's it. And Wienergate. Oh, my God. Oh. Let's take a break.
When you can't find the friends to get the radio. I got a double O18 to Martin Guitar in
anger management. It's Mike Malloy.
We would hang together, or they hang us one by one.
Twenty-two past the hour. I did not mention Monday, and was totally remiss. The death of poet and musician Gil Scott-Heron over the weekend. I think on Friday, Saturday. I think. The 27th. When was the 27th? He, of course, was known for a lot of things. He told the Telegraph of the UK about a year ago that he always felt that people misinterpreted his spoken word screed against mass media. The revolution will not be televised. He said to the Telegraph, quote, that was satire. People would try and argue that it was this militant message, but just how militant can you really be when you're saying the revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner? My songs were always about the tone of voice rather than the words. A good comic will deliver a line deadpan that let the audience laugh. A lot of hip-hop artists say that Scott-Heron, who was born in Chicago, was the father of that particular branch of pop music, although Gil Scott-Heron always said no. Mm-mm. Anyway, poet Gil Scott-Heron died. He was only 62, and at the time that his death was announced, I don't think any cause of death was listed specifically, although he was having, for an awful long time, severe drug addiction and other health problems. But I have a poster in this house up above the studio here in the foothills of the North Georgia Mountains. It's a benefit, the Muse benefit in Madison Square Garden from 1979. You know that one up on the back porch? And in 1979, at that concert, he performed with Bruce Springsteen and Jackson Browne and others. In 1985, he sang the protest anthem Sun City with Bob Dylan, Steve Van Zandt, Run DMC, Lou Reed, and Miles Davis. But anyway, there's nothing, you know, that I can or should even attempt to add. Gil Scott-Heron dead at 62 from whatever. Whatever. The thing I wanted to get to, the truth about the American economy, I just think it's important. I like to think that a couple of years ago I forwarded to Robert Reich the piece written by Clint Gold, a former mayor of a town in Oklahoma. What have Republicans ever done for the working person? And you've heard me read it on this program over the years. There's a piece, and Clint Gold had been in the banking industry, and then he wound up as a mayor of the small town Oklahoma. But you can rest assured that he was probably a small town banker and treated people with respect. But in that article, Clint Gold wrote about all the things that were done to build and rescue the middle class, returning veterans, people who want to go to school, that the Democrats have done over the years. And the gist of it was, you know, what have Republicans ever done? And of course, there's no answer, because Republicans have never done anything positive. I've had that challenge out there for 20 years. Any Republican who can call whatever program I'm doing on whatever radio station and tell me one single thing that Republicans have done to benefit the working people in this country, call me. Send me an email. Send it by snail mail. And the challenge has been out there for 20 years, and nobody. I mean, they have no problem writing about wishing my wife dead and my child would get AIDS, or that I die of cancer screaming in my own feces, but they won't answer that simple challenge. And the reason for it is because Republicans have never done anything for working people. So I sent that piece on to Robert Reich's website. I don't know if he got it or not. But in reading what he wrote May the 31st, I tend to think that he did.
Why does everything cost so much money? Could somebody please help out my family? My mom needs hearing aids, new shoulders and new legs. My dad needs a break, he works all day every day. My brother needs a place and a job where he can make enough money to take care of his baby.
Because liberal is a good word, it's More Mike Malloy.
Before the hour. So Robert Reich, in his latest blog, says the U.S. economy continues to stagnate. It's growing at a rate of 1.8%, which is barely growing at all. Consumer spending is down. Home prices are down. Jobs and wages are going nowhere. It's vital that we understand the truth about the American economy. How do we go from the Great Depression to 30 years of great prosperity, and from there to 30 years of stagnant incomes and widening inequality, culminating in the Great Recession? And from the Great Recession into such an anemic recovery? During the three decades from 1947 to 1977, the nation implemented what might be called a basic bargain with American workers. Employers paid them enough to buy what they produced. Mass production and mass consumption proved perfect complements. Almost everyone who wanted a job could find one with good wages, or at least wages that were trending upward. During these three decades, everyone's wages grew, not just those at or near the top. Government enforced the basic bargain in several ways. It used Keynesian policy to achieve nearly full employment. It gave ordinary workers more bargaining power. It provided social insurance, and it expanded public investment. Consequently, the portion of total income that went to the middle class grew, while the portion going to the top declined. But this was no zero-sum game. As the economy grew, almost everyone came out ahead, including those at the top. The pay workers in the bottom fifth grew 116% over these years, faster than the pay of those in the top fifth, which rose 99%, and in the top 5%, which rose 86%. Productivity also grew quickly. Labor productivity, average output per hour worked, doubled. So did median incomes. Expressed in 2007 dollars, the typical family's income rose from about $25,000 to $55,000. The basic bargain was cinched. The middle class had the means to buy, and their buying created new jobs. As the economy grew, the national debt shrank as a percentage of the economy. The Great Prosperity also marked the culmination of a reorganization of work that had begun during the Depression. Employers were required by law to provide extra pay, time and a half, for work stretching beyond 40 hours a week. This created an incentive for employers to hire additional workers when demand picked up. Employers also were required to pay a minimum wage, which improved the pay of workers near the bottom as demand picked up. When workers were laid off, usually during an economic downturn, government provided them with unemployment benefits, usually lasting until the economy recovered, and they were rehired. Not only did this tide families over, but it kept them buying goods and services, an automatic stabilizer for the economy in downturns. Perhaps most significantly, government increased the bargaining leverage of ordinary workers. They were guaranteed the right to join labor unions with which employers had to bargain in good faith. By the mid-1950s, more than a third of all American workers in the private sector were unionized. And the unions demanded and received a fair share of the American pie. Non-unionized companies, fearing their workers would otherwise want a union, offered similar deals. Americans also enjoyed economic security against the risks of economic life, not only unemployment benefits, but also through Social Security, insurance against disability, loss of a major breadwinner, workplace injury, and inability to save enough for retirement. In 1965 came health insurance for the elderly and the poor, Medicare and Medicaid. Economic security proved the handmaiden of prosperity. And requiring Americans to share the costs of adversity enabled them to share the benefits of peace, peace of mind. And by offering peace of mind, it freed them to consume the fruits of their labors. The government sponsored the dreams of American families to own their own home by providing low-cost mortgages and interest deductions on mortgage payments. In many sections of the country, government subsidized electricity and water to make such homes habitable. And it built the roads and freeways that connected the homes with major commercial centers. Government also widened access to higher education. The GI Bill paid college costs for those who returned from war. The expansion of public universities made higher education affordable to the American middle class. Government paid for all of this with tax revenues from an expanding middle class with rising incomes. Revenues also were boosted by those at the top of the income ladder whose marginal taxes were far higher. The top marginal income tax rate during World War II was over 68%. In the 1950s, under Eisenhower, whom few would call a radical, it rose to 91%. In the 1960s and 70s, the highest marginal rate was around 70%. Even after exploiting all possible deductions and credits, the typical high-income payer paid a marginal federal tax rate of over 50%. But contrary to what conservative commentators had predicted, the high tax rates did not reduce economic growth. To the contrary, they enabled the nation to expand middle-class prosperity and fuel growth. During the Great Prosperity of 1947 to 1977, the basic bargain had ensured that the pay of American workers coincided with their output. In effect, the vast middle class received an increasing share of the benefits of economic growth. But after that point, the two lines began to diverge. Output per hour, a measure of productivity, continued to rise. But real hourly compensation was left in the dust. It's easy to blame globalization for the stagnation of middle incomes. But technological advances have played as much, if not a greater role. Factories remaining in the United States have shed workers as they automated. So has the service sector. But contrary to popular mythology, trade and technology have not reduced the overall number of American jobs. Their more profound effect has been on pay. Rather than be out of work, most Americans have quietly settled for lower real wages, or wages that have risen more slowly than the overall growth of the economy per person. Although unemployment following the Great Recession remains high, jobs are slowly returning, but in order to get them, many workers have to accept lower pay than before. Starting more than 30 years ago, trade and technology began driving a wedge between the earnings of people at the top and everyone else. The pay of well-connected graduates of prestigious colleges and MBA programs has soared, but the pay and benefits of most other workers has either flattened or dropped. And the ensuing division has also made most middle-class American families less economically secure. Government could have enforced the basic bargain, but it did the opposite. It slashed public goods and investments, whacking school budgets, increasing the cost of public higher education, reducing job training, cutting public transportation, and allowing bridges, ports, and highways to corrode. It shredded safety nets, reducing aid to jobless families with children, tightening eligibility for food stamps, and cutting unemployment insurance so much that by 2007, only 40% of the unemployed were covered. It cut in half the top income tax rate from the range of 60 to 90% that prevailed during the Great Prosperity to 28 to 35%, allowing many of the nation's rich to treat their incomes as capital gains, subject to more than 15% tax. And it shrunk inheritance taxes that affected only the topmost 1.5% of earners. Yet at the same time, Americans boosted sales and payroll taxes. America boosted sales and payroll taxes, both of which took a bigger chunk out of the pay of the middle class and the poor than of the well-off. How do we keep buying given all this? Well, there were three coping mechanisms. Coping mechanism number one, women moved into paid work. The transition of women into paid work has been one of the most important social and economic changes to occur over the last four decades. In 1966, 20% of mothers with young children worked outside the home. By the late 90s, the proportion had risen to 60%. For married women with children under the age of six, the transformation has been even more dramatic, from 12% in the 60s to 55% by the late 90s. Coping mechanism number two, everyone works longer hours. A growing number of people took on two or three jobs. All told, by the 2000s, the typical American worker worked more than 2,200 hours a year, 350 hours more than the average American worked, or the average European worked, more hours even than the typically industrious Japanese put in. It was many more hours than the typical American middle-class family had worked in 1979. 500 hours longer, a full 12 weeks more. Coping mechanism number three, draw down savings and borrow to the hilt. And as Reich points out, all three coping mechanisms have been exhausted. The fundamental economic challenge ahead is to restore the vast American middle class. That requires resurrecting the basic bargain linking wages to overall gains and providing the middle class a share of economic gains sufficient to allow them to purchase more of what the economy can produce. Now let me ask you, Truth Seeker, do you really see that happening? Is corporate America, capitalist America, going to say, hey, we were just kidding? We want the middle class to make the greatest comeback since Lazarus. No.
There'll be no place for us to go. Bosses of the world.
Ten before the hour, this hour has been sponsored by Russell Noel. Thank you, Russell. No message, just from Russell. I get very angry when I see what has happened, you know, to my country and the ongoing destruction by right-wingers, by Republicans, by the cockroaches, especially people who, in my opinion, should know better. I mean, for Christ's sake, we all live in the same country. Do people really think that the problems that this country faces right now have anything whatsoever to do with Barack Obama? I mean, the only problems that have to do with his leadership is the fact that he's now ordered his Justice Department to respect the U.S. Constitution where it concerns detainees and torture and international law. A, B, he hasn't ordered his Justice Department to go after with every means available the war criminals who ran this country for 8 years. But as far as policies are concerned, Obama's policies are just a continuation of policies started by Reagan, I guess. I guess you could go back further if you wanted to, but Reagan and then his freakish vice president, George Herbert Walker, and then Clinton, and then the war criminal who was handed the presidency by an out-of-control neo-fascist Supreme Court. They're going to blame Obama? My irritation with Obama, and it's much more than that, are the things I just mentioned, but also the fact that he doesn't bring a stop, an end to this goddamn craziness, which he could do. He could do. Combination of using the so-called bully pulpit and presidential directives, he could do it. But he won't do it. That's my argument with Obama. But for the people who try to blame him, just like this freakish Mitt Romney, and why are people interviewing Mitt Romney? You know, I get the feeling that I'm at we're all being forced to go to a peep show. All these, will he, won't he, will she, won't he, will he, won't she, will she, won't she, and the media just keeps playing it up, just like following the spoor of this woman who's really in heat for something. I don't know what the hell she's in heat for, Sarah Palin, but she's leaving her smell all over the place. And of course, media, being the hounds that they are following. Oh yeah, any place Sarah goes, we'll be there. What's this? A Tea Party organizer? What in the hell? Bob is in Russellville, Arkansas. You're a Tea Party organizer?
Why, yes.
Well, why are you calling me? I don't like people like you. I think you're insane.
Oh, no, you don't.
Oh, yes, I do. Well, what the hell? What the hell are you? What do you mean you're a Tea Party organizer? You go out there and convince people to vote against their own best interests?
No, Art.
How old are you? How old are you, Bob?
Hey,
Bob. Bob, how old are you?
67.
57. Are you?
No, 67.
67. Well, you're on the government tit, then, aren't you?
Probably, yeah.
Well, why, you phony? You hypocrite?
No, why are you doing that?
Because you are.
Wait.
No, kiss my lily white ass. What do you mean? You're sitting out there at age 67 sucking up Medicare and Social Security? You phony bastard, get off my phone. Get off my radio program, Tea Party Organizer. I got your Tea Party Organizer. Smarmy bastards that call in here with that kind of attitude. I'm a Tea Party Organizer down in Arkansas. You are? How old are you? 67. You get Social Security and Medicare? Well, I reckon I do. You goddamn hypocrite. Get off my program. The nerve of these people. What did he say, Gabby? He liked the show? I got some like the show for you, pal. You like the show. God. Tim is in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. Hello, Tim.
Hey, Mike. Nice to talk to you. Been listening to you for quite a while now on XM, and or Sirius, I should say, but really enjoy the show.
Great. Well, thanks. Appreciate it.
Hey, I could just like to say I was at a couple of rallies in Madison. I'm a union truck driver in the state here, and people really got woke up to what's going on with these Tea Partiers. News report, I was just talking to one of my fellow coworkers tonight. His wife just became a school teacher, and he was a very radical right came in from driving a lot of nights, telling me all the stuff about what he's been hearing on the radio. He was listening to a lot of the, you know, Limbaugh's back
right,
and all
right,
that stuff. And,
right.
Tonight he was completely talking the other way. It was unbelievable. I said, "What, you switch sides?" And he said, "Yeah, I can't believe this. What's going on with our government, Walker? Our Governor Walker?" So.
Yeah, and you know, Tim, I hate to over-talk you here, but we've got about 10 seconds before the music starts to play. There it is. The only thing I can hope, Tim, is that, if I have any hope left, is that people like the guy you're referring to will come out of the anesthesia and realize that the Republicans have cut his throat. And that they'll do something about that. That's the only hope we have in this country. That or open revolution. Tim, I got to leave it there. Thanks, pal. I appreciate you checking in. We'll talk again, I hope. Take care. I'll see you tomorrow night, True Seekers. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. Captain Mark John.